All right, so thanks again for everyone coming back. Glad I didn't scare off too many of you. It's good. So we're picking back up. We'll just jump right back into it. So kind of slight review. We're in Genesis still. So if this is your first time, you only missed like 5 chapters, so that's okay. So not too much missed, but we'll try to cover a little bit more tonight. Okay, so kind of where we've been last week. Again, we kind of covered Genesis 1 through 5. That's where we started getting into. Again, we've seen God's kind of plan or agenda moving forward, where we started out with creation, and then we've seen kind of things develop with the creation of man and woman. We saw the fall. We saw Cain and Abel, and then even chapter 5, where we saw kind of a genealogy, where we got to see some of the effects of the fall taking place, right? Where this emphasis on people dying, essentially, right? And then also we pointed out some factors in there that are connecting us to events that we're going to talk about today, with like the flood and everything, okay? If you guys remember Methuselah, right? We talked about him, where that he's kind of, you could say he's like the ticking time clock, right? Where it's essentially his name means after like he dies, like it is sent, talking about like the flood, okay? And so he is kind of that kind of sign there of once he dies, the flood is coming. And so he's like that time clock. His father Enoch is the one kind of prophet, like calling for repentance, all that with the wickedness of man, and everything with that. Okay, and then we also started to see kind of the first mentions of Noah, okay, coming up as well in chapter 5, and kind of the impact we'll see over these next few chapters. Okay, so we are picking up in chapter 6. We'll look at these first 8 verses. And the handout you got, like, that kind of has some overlap from last week again. And this actually will kind of take you through all of Genesis. We're not going to get through all. I was ambitious when I made the notes. I was like, we could do it. We could finish Genesis tonight. But then when I started actually writing my notes, we are not going to do that. So we're hoping to get through Abraham. We'll see if we do that tonight as well. Okay, so first 8 verses we're going to talk about in chapter 6. What we see here is these are kind of transitionary verses where we're kind of wrapping up the Toledot, which again, remember, that's kind of the structure of Genesis, this Toledot. I have a new marker that you can see. Yeah, so Toledot, which is like the Hebrew word for genealogies or generations, and that's really how Genesis is structured, if you remember that, is kind of these various generations. And so we are wrapping up the Toledot of Adam, and we're going to be entering the Toledot of Noah, okay? And so these 8 verses are kind of this hinge into those, between those sections, okay? And what we're going to see in these first 8 verses of chapter 6 is this emphasis on kind of why a flood is necessary. Okay, why is a flood necessary? And as we see kind of the depravity of mankind on display here. Okay, and even though we've seen that already, like in the line of Cain, if you remember that, the actions of Cain murdering his brother Abel, and there's some other aspects of his line where we've seen the wickedness of man on display. Now we see an even more clear display in these first 8 verses, okay? And maybe you've read these verses and you kind of wonder what in the world is going on here. Who are these sons of God? Who are the, what we call like the Nephilim? What is going on? And so let's kind of unpack this. So first, let's look at the sons of God. So if you are picking up chapter 6, right? Let's see. I'll just read the first couple. It says, when man began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive and they took as their wives any they chose. Okay. And then you have the Lord proclaiming again. Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. And then you have this mention of, again, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward when the sons of God came into the daughters of man and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. And then talks about the wickedness of the man after that, right? Lord talks about that. And so a question of like, okay, let's identify first, like, who are these sons of God, these daughters of men, what's going on in this situation? And so there's a lot of options we could kind of go through, but again, we're going to try to move quicker. So kind of the two main options that are thrown out there that I think have like legitimacy here is one view takes the sons of God as referring to the godly line of Seth, okay? The godly line of like Eve. If you remember, we were talking about in Genesis 3, the establishment of like there's going to be the line of the serpent, okay, which is like in line with the devil, essentially, the wickedness of man. And then the line of the woman, which will be the godly line who like the seed would come through, okay? And so this first view takes the sons of God referred to here as those of the line of Seth, okay? So the line of Eve and the godly line, I guess you could say. And then the daughters of man would be kind of the line of the serpent, okay? And so the ungodly line of Cain. And so the idea is they say that, okay, like this is the godly line of Seth is intermarrying with the ungodly line of Cain, okay, is kind of this first view. And kind of the rationale behind that is that seems to be what's been going on the past few chapters, and what's going to kind of continue in the next few is this kind of balance between the line of the seed and the line of the serpent, okay, and kind of that distinction. And then the other main option takes the sons of God as referring to angels, or like fallen angels, essentially, okay? And kind of responding to, you have, like I said, the main rationale of the first option is kind of the context, which is good, so it kind of fits. However, this term sons of God, kind of especially in earlier Hebrew literature, like in Genesis or like in Job even, if you read that, is pretty much often mostly used for angels, okay? Like if you remember at the beginning of Job, when it talks about God summoning the sons of God to him, and that clearly there is a reference to angels, okay? So kind of the Hebrew literature uses that terminology for sons of God to refer to angels. But then we also have other support from like later on in the New Testament. If you remember in the books of 2 Peter as well as Jude, they make some references back to these angels who kind of went beyond their bounds and like therefore were imprisoned and stuff like that till the day of judgment. If you guys remember that from 2 Peter 2:4 and Jude 6. And this would again seem to be pointing back to this event. There's not really another event that seems to go along with that. And even like some literature from before the time of Jesus, like in between the Old and New Testament, the intertestamental period, like the Book of Enoch, it's called. It's not like a biblical book, but it's from that time period, and they interpreted this as referring to angels as well. If you ever want to read the Book of Enoch, it's a crazy read, so go ahead, go for it. It's pretty interesting. It really unpacks these verses right here, where it's almost like fan fiction for the Nephilim. All right, it's pretty interesting. So if you have some time, you can read through that. Again, not biblical, but something around that time, okay, to support that view. All right, and so that's what kind of seems to be the case, okay, is that this is referring to angels here. These sons of God are referring to angels. And so, okay, so what do we have going on here, right? And it seems to be that you have kind of here's this plan of Satan, all right, some sort of plot where it almost be like kind of this, the angels intermarrying with mankind and producing some sort of half-human, half-angel type of people. That's kind of the plot, right? That's kind of this idea. And we have to recognize that who is in on this, though? It's not just like the angels. Who else is in on this? It's mankind, right? That is going along with this in a sense, okay? So mankind is involved. Angels are involved. Satan is involved and all that, okay? And so this seems to be kind of the plot, okay? This is what Satan is thinking. And we don't exactly know what he's thinking, right, in this. And again, maybe it's this, he thinks, yeah, we're going to have these half-human, half-angels, and maybe they're not, like, redeemable or whatever. Like, you're like, yeah, this sounds like a crazy plot. This sounds very intense. And essentially, again, this idea of trying to revolt against the Lord, that's really what all this is this rebellion against God. But notice, like, in verse 3, where it talks about the Lord states, like, my spirit shall not abide in man, or some translations might say, like, contend with man, because what? He is flesh, okay? And so the idea being, like, no matter how mankind tries to rebel or teams up with Satan or whatever, tries to do this, they are ultimately what? Flesh. He is God. They are creation. Okay, and so he's not worried, and he even says that his days shall be 120 years. Okay, and why the 120 years? Do you guys know what comes after that? The flood, right? Yeah, the flood will come, right? So we have this kind of, again, countdown happening here, right? We have 120 years until the flood takes place. Okay, and so then the question is, well, did this plan work? All right, did this plan work? Did Satan's plot of with the angels, all that, like, did this work? And that's where we come to verse 4, and we have these mentionings of the Nephilim. All right, the Nephilim, that term just means, like, kind of to fall, okay, and really carries the idea of, like, something big. And so I think somebody mentioned, I can't remember, that I think even in, like, Israel, I think some of their supersized sizes are like Nephilim or something. They're called like that because it's like they're tall, right? Kind of a thing. And so it really just has this idea of, like, to fall. The idea is something big or tall. And even, like, the Greek translation of this translated, it's like giants is kind of the term that's used. And we're, I think, tempted to think, right? Like, oh man, so that's crazy. So we have, like, these giant half angel, half man, kind of supernatural beings, like hybrid creatures roaming around. Like, that sounds intense. But then notice what the text says here. Is it says the Nephilim are on the earth in those days and also afterwards. Okay? And so the emphasis seems to be that nothing really out of the ordinary happened. Okay? That all that this produced was what? Tall people. Right? And it's on the wording there, right? Notice the wording is not from then on there were Nephilim. It was like, no, in those days there were Nephilim and there were some afterwards. Meaning what? There was tall people before this. This event happened. It produced tall people. And there still was tall people later on. So really, nothing happened, right? Like, this whole massive plot of Satan and man going against God, all that, just produced tall people that would die, right, in the flood. Like, they wouldn't do anything, okay? Like, this whole elaborate plot really accomplished nothing, okay, is the idea of these verses, right? Does that make sense? We kind of track in with that a little bit. Any questions on that? But in the midst of that, right, we see the wickedness of man on display, because, again, they are part of this. And so notice verse 5, right, where it says, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and every intention of his, of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Okay? And we see that the Lord is grieved over this. Okay? He's grieved over the wickedness of man. Okay? And so you start to see why the flood is necessary. Okay? Why the flood is necessary. But then at the end of this, you see kind of a bright spot of, okay, like, this indication of how God's plan is actually going to move forward, though, in verse 8. So in contrast to the wickedness going on, it says in verse 8, what? But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Okay, so you start to see there's the glimmer of hope there. That's where God's plan is going to move forward, is through this guy Noah. Okay, and then the next verse, what? You have, these are now the generations of Noah, right? So now we're moving into this toledot of Noah. Does anyone have any questions on that section before we move on? You good? All right, so the generations of Noah. So probably most kind of common part of Noah's life we're familiar with is the flood, okay? And so kind of the main idea here in this section of kind of this, the flood section here, is what God is accomplishing in the flood is that God resets and judges the world so that his plan can continue in it, okay? So kind of repeat that. So it's God resets and judges the world so that his plan will continue. Okay? And so we see God give Noah instructions on how to build the ark. And we see Noah's faithful to build it. Notice in verse 18 of chapter 6, God also mentions the fact that he will establish a covenant with Noah, which we'll see kind of detailed later on in chapter 9, I believe it is. We'll get to that. But just keep that in your mind for now, that he will establish this covenant. That's kind of the first covenant that we see mentioned here in Scripture, which we'll call like the Noahic covenant. And we'll address that later on. It's important, but we'll get to it. Okay? So chapter 6, again, God instructs Noah to build this ark. This judgment is coming. Build the ark. And chapter 6 ends with Noah doing all that God commanded. So he's obedient, listens to the Lord. And then we come into chapter 7 of Genesis, where we see the flood actually take place. Okay, the flood is brought upon the earth, and we see that unfold. All right? And so, as we touch on this topic of flood, right, there's some people who discuss, like, okay, was this actually a global flood, or was this just like a major local flood? Okay, and people have some different thoughts on that. But I think we believe like that this is a global flood, okay? And I think Scripture supports that. Just some of the reasons why for that. First off, we have kind of the language that's used is language of a global flood. Like if you notice verse 19 of chapter 7, it says, "And the waters prevailed so mightily on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered." Okay, so all the high mountains over under the whole heaven, okay, so like under all the sky, right? Like, so it's have this terminology of kind of all used or everything, okay, and so it's not just local. But then you also have like afterwards, you have God promise not to destroy the earth in the same way, okay, and if it's a local flood, I think there's been quite a few local floods around the world, right, like since then, and so again, that doesn't seem to make sense either. But it makes sense if it's a global flood that God will not destroy the world in that same way. And then also just consider the fact of God instructing Noah to build this ark. Like if it was just a local thing and he has like 100 years, what? He could just say, hey, just start kind of walking that way and get out of here. You have 100 years, start walking, you'll be fine, right? Like just kind of move out of the way a little bit, right? Rather than spend like 100 years building a big boat, right? Just to like, oh, I could have just gone over there. Like, what? Okay. Yeah, so probably, again, global flood, all right? And even Peter in 2 Peter connects this to a global connection as well. Okay, so we believe global flood, not just local. Okay? So that's what's going on here. All right, so Noah builds the ark, gets the animals and all that in the ark, and God sends the flood. And notice verses 11 and 12 of this chapter. Can I get someone else to read that so you guys can hear a different voice? Someone else has got to step up. Terry isn't here to be our reader. So, verses 11 and 12 of chapter 7.
All right, got it. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth.
Oh, wait, chapter 7.
Chapter 7, 11. All right, chapter 7. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened, and rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights.
Awesome. So notice the language that's used there, right? So it says the fountains of the great deep were burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened, and rain fell upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. And so you have this idea of water is not just coming from above, but from where? Beneath, right? It says the deeps are bursting forth. So it's almost like mankind is crushed between these two, like from the bottom and the top, okay? And notice it's for 40 days and 40 nights. That's not the total time that Noah is in the ark. That's just how long the waters are like bursting forth, right? So for 40 days, 40 nights straight, you have the waters bursting from below and above, for all that time, okay? And then we'll see a little bit like later when the waters recede, it's like even over like another 150 days, all right? So this is like a long chunk of time that's happening here. It's multiple months that is going on here. Okay? Well, that's why we have chapter 7. So chapter 8, we kind of pick up with God remembering Noah. Okay? So it says, but God remembered Noah and all the beasts and the livestock that were with him in the ark. And that's not like God forgot. That's not like God sent the flood and was like, ooh, oh, Noah, let me get you, right? Like, that's not like what's going on. But the idea of remembering is God's like focused attention on that person, on that individual. And so he is going to intervene and help Noah at this time, okay? Let's see. But notice, right, even with this imagery that's going here, so when he remembers Noah, and we see the flood water start to kind of recede and the dry land appear. And we can't miss the imagery here, right? Because notice what this looks like. You have this world covered with water, and then now like dry land is coming out of it. What does that kind of sound familiar to us of what we saw earlier in Genesis? Huh? Yeah, creation, right? Do you remember creation? Back in Genesis 1, where the world was like, filled with, like, it was just water, right, essentially, like Genesis 1. Yeah, like, it says, like, in verse 2, like, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters, so just waters, and then you have the dry land appear, right, as God creates, and there's a separation between land and sea. We saw that in the days of creation, and so here, you have this imagery of kind of recreation, okay, and that's what I kind of mentioned. One of the twofold purposes was not only just judgment, but was also this kind of resetting, that it was this restoration of creation. That's what's going on. Okay, so that's why you have this creation imagery kind of used again, is to show it's almost kind of, we hit the reset button here a little bit, and now it's resetting, this restoration of creation. Okay? All right. And then I think we have to keep in mind, too, just the reality of what this was. Like, there was obviously judgment involved. And you have Noah send out a raven, and it doesn't come back. And do you guys know why a raven doesn't come back? What's a raven? Like, what do they feed on? Yeah, they're scavengers, right? They're like, they feed on dead things, right? And so what is outside of the ark, essentially, at this point? Death, right? Death. And I think sometimes, like, I don't know. We always seem to have, like, Noah's Ark is, like, something for the kids, right? Where it's, like, Noah's Ark, and it's all these, like, happy animals on the ocean or something like that. But if you really stop and think, like, what did Noah come out to? It was death, right? Like, that'd be devastating. And you can imagine him, right? Like, of kind of this response of, like, thank God, right? Like, that should have been me. But God showed me grace. And so we see that reality, right? And that's why it leads to him in this next section, kind of offering burnt offerings to the Lord, right, as worship for that. Okay, so it takes us into this section that talks about God's covenant with Noah. Like I mentioned, he would make this covenant, and now we have that actually taking place here. Okay, so we have, kind of picking up this section, the end of chapter 8, God promises to not curse the ground in this way again, like he did the fall, and that doesn't negate the curse, right? But it's just, it's not going to kind of flesh itself out in the same way anymore. There's some restoration here in the land, as we'll see in a moment here. But notice also at the end of chapter 8, the kind of institution of seasons. We kind of mentioned that last time, of one of the ways God, this restoration of the flood, what he would do and what God would do, is that now there would be like actual seasons taking place. There would be the stability of seasons. Because remember, pre-flood, this seems to indicate or imply that there was no like seasons. It would just change from day to day of kind of hot, cold, all this stuff, right? Like, to where that'd make it very difficult to plant anything or to survive, right? But we see God providing some form of that rest, that restoration, that now in verse 22, it talks about this institution of seasons. There will be some stability taking place here. Okay? All right. And that takes us into chapter 9. And notice right off the bat where it says there in verse 1 that God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them. All right? So we have this idea of blessing. Where have we seen blessing before? We've gone through in Genesis. We talked about that. guys remember. Where do we see God blessing some people? There's not too many chapters we've covered, so you have a good shot. Remember? Yeah, Adam and Eve, like Genesis 1, all right? If you remember the creation of man and woman, that God blessed them, okay? That idea of blessing, that we talked about, that was like God allowing people to enjoy his creation, okay? That all he's created, and it's supposed to culminate in worship of him, okay? That was the idea of blessing. And so back in chapter 1, when he made man and woman, it says, and he blessed them, okay? Verse 28 of chapter 1 says, and God blessed them. Okay, and to further emphasize that connection back to Genesis 1, what does God say? He blesses them, and then he says what? Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Saw that where? Yeah, Genesis 1, Adam and Eve, right? Like same area, all right? And so again, this is to connect back with Genesis 1 so that to point that God's plan is continuing to move forward. Okay, God's plan is continuing to move forward. We're heading in one direction, which is back where? Creation, right? We're getting back to the original creation, that relationship with God. And we're going to see that the Noahic covenant not only kind of regulates stuff on the earth, but it's also the covenant about where the earth is going, right? That's this link back to this blessing, this going back to this relationship with God, okay? So God's plan is continuing to move forward. And we see that it is through Noah and this covenant that that plan is moving forward. All right. And so part of moving that forward, we see God restraining sin in kind of a couple of different ways and everything, where we see in verse 2 that God, we mentioned this last week as well, but God puts the fear of man into animals. So again, before the flood, it doesn't seem like animals really had any fear of man. So not only did you have crazy days and no seasons, you also had animals just, I'm going to attack that guy, right? Like, not scared of him. And so God puts a fear of man in animals, right? So it's not, they don't attack in the same way, okay? But then you also see the restraint of kind of the establishment of some sort of like authority in verses 6 and 7, where it talks about like, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. Okay, and so this idea of there's some repercussions of if you kill someone, you will be killed, right? And that should hopefully restrain some of that sin as well. Okay, so that's all part of moving things forward. And so then we see God establish this covenant. Verse 8 and 9, right, where it says, God said to Noah and his sons, behold, I establish my covenant with you. So this is that first covenant, Noahic covenant. And what does he promise to do there? Do you guys remember, what does he promise not to do there? Never to do what? Yeah, never flood the earth again, like that. And then what's the sign of that covenant? Yeah, the bow, right? Notice verse 12. And this is the sign of my covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all the future generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Okay? I mean, it's like the rainbow, right? And I think we often just think of the rainbow as like, oh, yeah, that's like beautiful, right? That's a cool sign, right? Like, it's so peaceful, and that's what God's doing. But the word used there, like, is bow. Like, as in, like, a bow and arrow, right? That's kind of what the term is that's being used there. And so what's going on here is that essentially God is saying, what? Like, I'm placing my weapon on the rack, right, essentially, or whatever you do with a bow. I don't want to store a bow, rack or something, backpack, I don't know. But he's setting it off to the side, right? Like, that is saying, like, he's not bringing this judgment, right? He's placing it off to the side, okay? But then zoom ahead, like, later on in, like, the Old Testament, we'll get to eventually, not this 8 weeks, but eventually, in the book of Ezekiel, in Ezekiel 1, when Ezekiel is trying to talk about what the throne of God looks like and different things and the imagery he uses, and in there he mentions that there's a bow with him. And I think, again, a lot of people just assume, like, oh, yeah, that just is emphasizing the beauty of the Lord or stuff like that. But what's actually the context? What, the bow's no longer off on the rack in the sky. It's what? He's got it ready, right? And what you see in Ezekiel is what? He's coming to bring judgment, right? And that's really the message there, okay, in Ezekiel 1. And so, again, kind of connects with all that, okay? All right, so this covenant is made. God's plan is moving forward, okay? Any questions on any of that? Again, I know we're going a little quicker, but I have to get through. All right, and so then we have Noah's sons in the rest of chapter 9 here, the last kind of half here of chapter 9, talking about Noah's sons. And so we have this question because Noah has how many sons? Do you guys remember? Three. All right, and one of the main questions of Genesis is kind of this narrowing down of who the seed of Genesis 3:15, right? Who's this future one to come, the line of the seed? Kind of who is this going to continue through, okay, as we narrow down. And so the question is, which of the three sons does this continue through? And that's really the question of this last section here. And that's kind of the importance of this section, is to show that it is going to be through the line of Shem, okay? We see a couple of things to point out. We won't go into too much detail here, but a couple of things to point out. Noah plants a vineyard and it actually grows, okay? So again, that's showing that the flood actually did provide some sort of restoration. Things are growing. But then do you remember what Noah does immediately after planting the vineyard? Things grow. What happens? Yeah, he gets drunk, all right? Like, and kind of gets drunk, passes out all that. And again, to show like the sinfulness of man is still there, right? The flood didn't fix that. That's still a thing. That needs to be dealt with, okay? But we see he passes out. Then one of his sons, Ham, we don't know the specifics, does something to shame his father, right? And all that. Whereas the other sons, Shem and Japheth, they act honorably and like help Noah and all that, okay? And that leads to the end of chapter 9, where Noah gives some kind of prophetic announcements about these sons and their descendants and kind of the implications will be for like the nations. And we see that Ham, that son, right? Like his line will be cursed. Okay, they will be the line that is cursed. Whereas Japheth will have blessing, as well as Shem will have blessing. But Japheth, they will have blessing within Shem. Okay, and so really the emphasis is it is through the line of Shem that this plan will continue. Okay, and Shem is actually where we get like the term Semite from, like when you think of like Semitic, like for Jews, that's from Shem, okay? So that's what we have. All right, so it's gonna, the plan's gonna continue through the line of Shem. All right, and then in chapter 10, we get the next Toledot, the generations of the sons of Noah. And chapter 10 is what we call the Table of Nations. Okay, I think Dan actually referenced this like last week in the main service, if you remember that. Passages that we might tend to skip over and stuff, I think is how we reference it. As in the context that he said we shouldn't, right? Like that he wasn't encouraging that. And so kind of make some couple notes here where we see kind of the descendants of Noah's sons, okay? So he kind of walks through the descendants of Ham and Shem and Japheth and all that, okay? And again, we're not going to read through all this, but we'll just point out a couple things here. In chapter 10, and really what we see is God like in control of the destiny of nations. That's kind of like the idea of what's happening here, that God is in control of the destiny of the nations. And what you're also going to see is as nations are established, then you're also going to need a nation to be a light to these other nations, right? Is kind of what you're going to see. And so you're going to have to see the singling out of a nation as well to do that. Let's see. All right. So we have, starts out descendants of Japheth. So we have all that. And then you have the sons of Ham. And again, we'll just point out a couple mentionings here. If you were looking through the list of Ham, you have some sons and descendants where you have the mentionings of like Egypt is like a descendant of him. You have Babylon and Assyria, Canaan, right? Like all these who were a lot of the enemies of Israel, right? Are descended from this line is kind of what we have here, all right? And real quick, on a kind of like a little side note, I think some people in the past have used these passages in a weird way, to where we can ask this question, just because someone is from, like, say, the, like, I don't know, at that time, like, the nation of Babylon, does that mean every single person in Babylon was, like, a wicked person and could never be saved? No, right? Like, there could be believers, like, people who come to faith who are from Babylon, right? This isn't to say that every single person in there is wicked, okay? And in the same way, flip side, with Israel, just because they're part of the nation of Israel, does that mean they're all, like, righteous and godly? No. There's a lot of wicked people in there as well, okay? So that's just the thing, where some people have used these verses to make some weird kind of applications, all right, of how to treat people not well, okay? But kind of the main takeaway, right, from this passage is the fact that God is, again, ordaining the destiny of nations, okay? That's what he is doing. And kind of a logical question we could ask is, okay, chapter 10, we suddenly have this idea of nations. How do we have nations, right? When did that come on the scene here? And chapter 11 actually gives us the answer. First nine chapters in the Tower of Babel, okay? And this explains why these nations exist. And we also see that God established nations as another restraint of sin, actually, okay? And so maybe you're familiar with these verses. But if you notice verse 1, it talks about how the earth, the whole earth, had one language and the same words, okay? So whole earth, had the same language, same words, so high level of communication where there's no misunderstandings, right? We're all speaking the same language, using the same words. And what do the people do with it, okay? That's the question. We see that they settle in the land of Shinar. And they decide to do what? Do you guys remember what they decide to do? They build a tower, right? They're like, we want to build a tower. We want to do this. And they describe it like verse 4. They want to build a tower with its top in the heavens. Okay, and we'll keep that in mind for something later. But then what else do they want to do in building this tower? What are they trying to do here? Huh? Sorry. Okay, yeah, kind of become gods, rebel against God. But specifically, what does it say in there? What are they trying? What do they want to do? They want to make what? Make a name for themselves, right? They want to make a name for ourselves. Do you remember so far in Genesis, who's primarily been the one doing the naming? Adam did it. But even before him, who gave him the authority to name? God, right? Back in chapter 1, God is the one doing the naming. And then chapter 2, God gives Adam that capability over creation, right? And so what are these people saying? Like, we don't want God to name us. We want to make a name for ourselves, right? It's this act of rebellion against God. And to make it clear that that's what their intention is, notice the last part of that. They want to let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. Why would that be rebellious? That statement of not wanting to be dispersed over the earth. Huh? Yeah, they're called to what? Be fruitful, multiply, and what? Fill the earth, right? That was what they're called to do, and they're saying, no, we don't want to do that. We want to stay here. We want to stay here. We don't want to get dispersed out. We want to stay here. We're going to build this tower to the heavens, right? Like, that's what we're going to do. And so we see that when mankind is unified, to where they have the same language, same words, high level communication, they use that unity to do what? Rebel, right? Rebel against God. And then we have verse 5 kind of come into play here, where notice it says, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And why is it kind of ironic a little bit here that it mentions God coming down to see this? Yeah, what was their goal, right? It's like, we're going to build this to the heavens. And God's essentially like, well, let me come down and see this, right? Because it's nowhere close to where I am, right? So let me come down and see your little tower. And that's what he does, right? So he comes down and he sees it. And again, he sees their rebellion. And what? He ends up like confusing their language. That's where we get languages, okay? And then he disperses them across the earth as well, all right? So his plan is continuing to move forward. And they call the place, it says Babel, because the Lord confused their language, the language of all the earth, okay? And from there, the Lord dispersed them over all the earth. And so God's plan is still moving forward, but we see that unfold, okay? And we see Babel, right? That's another word for like Babylon, and that becomes like kind of a center of rebellion against God, really. And you see that even in the book of Revelation, Babylon kind of comes back on the scene, and kind of the idea is what? Beginning to end, even though Babylon and the mankind will rebel, like God's never scared of it. God's never not in control. There's a continual emphasis. He is the creator. They are the creation. And just as he wins in Genesis, he will win in Revelation, right? Beginning to end, he wins, okay? And then before wrapping up here in this section, just a kind of side note, something that's kind of interesting that I think is good to kind of bring up is what we see here, right, is that languages are used here to what? To, or like when language is used to kind of like disperse people and all that, or used to scatter and disperse. But then if you remember later on in the Bible, there's a time where languages are actually used to like unite people. You guys remember like Acts 2, when the church is starting at the day of Pentecost, when Peter is preaching the gospel. And you remember what happens as he's preaching the gospel, all the people from the different nations are hearing him speak as if in their own language, okay? And they're hearing all that. And what you see there, right, is that in that instance, right, languages are uniting rather than dividing. And it's really kind of the reverse Babel, right, is what's going on there. Because what? Like in Genesis, when people were had the same language, what? They unified in rebellion to God. And now in Acts 2, they are unifying in what? Submission to God, right? Obedience to God. And so it really is kind of this reverse Babel. And so the question is, well, why is that kind of significant? Okay? Because what? The question throughout Scripture after the fall, as we've already seen, is kind of like, well, how do we get back? Right? How do we get back to this relationship with God? How do we get back to kind of this original creation where we have this relation with God? How do we get back to that? And that's really what Scripture is all answering. And what we see in like Acts 2 with that taking place in the birth of the church, essentially, right, as the church is established, is what? That how do you get back? It is through the work of Christ, right? That everything is being reversed, right? Babel is reversed. There is a way back, and it's through Christ. That God is able to do it, okay? He is able to bring us back, okay? And that's what the church really shows. And so you can understand then why it's significant for us as a body of believers to gather together as a church, because what? When we meet together as people from all different backgrounds, nationalities, all that, we are making a profound statement of the power of the gospel, that it has the power to what? Even reverse Babel, right? And so I think sometimes we can often think of like coming to church or being involved with the church as just kind of like a small thing, but in reality, like, that's one of the most kind of profound Christ exalting things you can do, right? Because when we meet together as a church, we're declaring to the world around us what? The gospel works. The work of Christ works because it is able to unify the nations, right? It's been able to unify people from all backgrounds, and it's all through the work of who? Christ, right? And so we have to see kind of those connections. So again, like I mentioned before, you can understand why Genesis in the Old Testament is foundational to a lot of even further things in Scripture, okay? Does that make sense? Yeah, tracking, okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And so we see God's plan is always that, right? And it will culminate at the end where all nations will be streaming to worship God, right? In that. All right. And then we'll make a little note real quick. We have the generations of Shem, the next Toledot, and just kind of briefly here, this again is just showing that we're moving from nations in general to the nation Israel is kind of the plan here at the end of chapter 7. And that's where it culminates in this little genealogy here with Abraham, or Abram at this point, okay, which is one of the forefathers, the founding fathers of the nation of Israel, okay? And that takes us into the generations of Terah, where we'll talk about Abram, but we'll take a break for right now, and we'll pick back up in a moment, all right?